Chapter 18. From that time I enjoyed the play. But the first thing I knew the curtain came down, like that, without my notice, and I hadn't any boots on. What's more, they wouldn't go on. I tugged strenuously. And the people in a row got up, and fussed and said things until the peach and I simply had to move on. We moved the girl on one arm, and the boots under the other. We walked home that way, 16 blocks, with a retinue a mile long. Every time we passed a lamp post, death gripped one at the throat. But we got home and I had on white socks. If I lived to be 999 years old, I don't suppose I could ever forget that walk. I remember it about as keenly as the chagrin I suffered on another occasion. At one time in our domestic history we had a colored butler who had a failing. He could never remember to ask people who came to the door to state their business. So I used to suffer a good many calls unnecessarily. One morning when I was especially busy he brought me a card engraved with a name I did not know. So I said, "What does he wish to see me for?" And Sylvester said, "I couldn't ask him, sir, he was a gentleman." Edern instantly, I thundered, and inquired his mission. Ask him what's his game. Well, Sylvester returned with the announcement that he had lightning rods to sell. Indeed, said I, things are coming to a fine pass when lightning rod agents send up engraved cards. He has pictures, added Sylvester. Pictures, indeed. He may be peddling etchings. Has he a Russia leather case? But Sylvester was too frightened to remember. I said, I am going down to make it hot for that upstart. I went down the stairs, working up my temper all the way. When I got to the parlor I was in a fine frenzy concealed beneath a veneer of frigid courtesy. And when I looked in the door, sure enough he had a Russia leather case in his hand. But I didn't happen to notice that it was a Russia leather case. And if you'd believe me, that man was sitting with a whole gallery of etchings spread out before him. But I didn't happen to notice that they were our etchings, spread out by some member of my family for some unguessed purpose. Very curtly I asked the gentleman his business. With a surprised, timid manner he faltered that he had met my wife and daughter at Antiora, and they had asked him to call. Fine lie, I thought, and I froze him. He seemed to be kind of nonplussed, and sat there fingering the etchings in the case until I told him he needn't bother, because we had those. That pleased him, so much that he leaned over, in an embarrassed way, to pick up another from the floor. But I stopped him. I said, "We've got that too." He seemed pitifully amazed, but I was congratulating myself on my great success. Finally the gentleman asked where Mr. Winton lived. He'd met him in the mountains too. So I said I'd show him gladly. And I did on the spot. And when he was gone I felt queer, because there were all his etchings spread out on the floor. Well, my wife came in, and asked me who had been in. I showed her the card, and told her all exultantly. To my dismay she nearly fainted. She told me he had been a most kind friend to them in the country, and had forgotten to tell me that he was expected our way. And she pushed me out of the door, and commanded me to get over to the Wintons, in a hurry, and get him back. I came into the drawing room, where Mrs. Winton was sitting up very stiff in a chair, beating me at my own game. Well, I began to put another light on things. Before many seconds Mrs. Winton saw it was time to change her temperature. In 5 minutes I had asked the man to luncheon, and she to dinner, and so on. We made that fellow change his trip and stay a week, and we gave him the time of his life. Why, I don't believe we let him get sober the whole time. I trust that you will carry away some good thought from these lessons I have given you, and that the memory of them will inspire you to higher things, and elevate you to plans far above the old, and I tell you one thing, young ladies. I've had a better time with you today than with that peach 53 years ago. Queen Victoria, address to the British Schools and Universities Club, at Delmonico's, Monday, May 25th. In honor of Queen Victoria's birthday, Mr. Clemens told the story of his duel with a rival editor. How he practiced firing at a barn door and failed to hit it, but a friend of his took off the head of a little bird at 35 yards, and attributed the shot to Mark Twain. The duel did not take place. Mr. Clemens continued as follows. It also happened that I was the means of stopping dueling in Nevada, for a law was passed sending all duelists to jail for 2 years, and the governor, hearing of my marksmanship, said that if he got me, I should go to prison for the full term. That's why I left Nevada, and I have not been there since. You do me a high honor, indeed, in selecting me to speak of my country in this commemoration of the birthday of that noble lady whose life was consecrated to the virtues and the humanities, and to the promotion of lofty ideals, and was a model upon which many a humbler life was formed, and made beautiful while she lived, and upon which many such lives will still be formed in the generations that are to come, a life which finds its just image in the star which falls out of its place in the sky, and out of existence, but whose light still streams with unfaded luster across the abysses of space long after its fires have been extinguished at their source. As a woman, the Queen was all that the most exacting standards could require. As a far-reaching and effective beneficent moral force, she had no peer in her time among either monarchs or commoners. As a monarch, she was without reproach in her great office. We may not venture, perhaps, to say so sweeping a thing as this in cold blood about any monarch that preceded her upon either her own throne or upon any other. It is a colossal eulogy, but it is justified. In those qualities of the heart which beget affection in all sorts and conditions of men, she was rich, surprisingly rich, and for this, she will still be remembered and revered in the far-off ages, when the political glories of her reign shall have faded from vital history, and fallen to a place in that scrap heap of unverifiable odds and ends which we call tradition. Which is to say, in briefer phrase, that her name will live always, and with it her character, a fame rare in the history of thrones, dominions, principalities, and powers, since it will not rest upon harvested selfish and sordid ambitions, but upon love, earned and freely vouchsafed. She mended broken hearts where she could, but she broke none. What she did for us in America in our time of storm and stress we shall not forget, and whenever we call it to mind we shall always remember the wise and righteous mind that guided her in it and sustained and supported her, Prince Albert's. We need not talk any idle talk here tonight about either possible or impossible war between the two countries. There will be no war while we remain sane, and the son of Victoria and Albert sits upon the throne. In conclusion, I believe I may justly claim to utter the voice of my country in saying that we hold him in deep honor, and also in cordially wishing him a long life and a happy reign. Joan of Arc, address at the dinner of the Society of Illustrators, given at the Eldon Association Club, December 22, 1905, just before Mr. Clemens made his speech. A young woman attired as Joan of Arc, with a page bearing her flag of battle, courtesied reverently and tendered Mr. Clemens a laurel wreath on a satin pillow. He tried to speak, but his voice failed from excess of emotion. I thank you, he finally exclaimed, and, pulling himself together, he began his speech. Now there is an illustration, pointing to the retreating Joan of Arc. That is exactly what I wanted, precisely what I wanted when I was describing to myself Joan of Arc, after studying her history and her character for 12 years diligently. That was the product, not the conventional Joan of Arc. Wherever you find the conventional Joan of Arc in history, she is an offense to anybody who knows the story of that wonderful girl. Why, she was almost supreme in several details. She had a marvelous intellect. She had a great heart, had a noble spirit, was absolutely pure in her character, her feeling, her language, her words, her everything. She was only 18 years old. Now put that heart into such a breast 18 years old and give it that masterly intellect which showed in the face, and furnish it with that almost godlike spirit, and what are you going to have? The conventional Joan of Arc? Not by any means. That is impossible. I cannot comprehend any such thing as that. You must have a creature like that young and fair and beautiful girl we just saw. And her spirit must look out of the eyes. The figure should be in harmony with all that. But, oh, what we get in the conventional picture, and it is always the conventional picture. I hope you will allow me to say that your guild, when you take the conventional, you have got it at second hand. Certainly, if you had studied and studied, then you might have something else as a result, but when you have the common convention you stick to that. You cannot prevail upon the artist to do it. He always gives you a Joan of Arc, that lovely creature, that started a great career at 13, but whose greatness arrived when she was 18. And merely, because she was a girl, he cannot see the divinity in her, and so he paints a peasant, a coarse and lubberly figure, the figure of a cotton bale, and he clothes that in the coarsest raiment of the peasant region just like a fish woman, her hair cropped short like a Russian peasant, and that face of hers, which should be beautiful, and which should radiate all the glories which are in the spirit and in her heart, that expression in that face is always just the fixed expression of a ham. But now Mr. Beard has intimated a moment ago, and so has Sir Purton Dash Clark also, that the artist, the illustrator, does not often get the idea of the man whose book he is illustrating. Here is a very remarkable instance of the other thing in Mr. Beard, who illustrated a book of mine. You may never have heard of it. I will tell you about it now, a Yankee in King Arthur's court. Now, Beard got everything that I put into that book and a little more besides. Those pictures of Beard's in that book, oh, from the first page to the last, is one vast sardonic laugh at the trivialities, the servilities of our poor human race, and also at the professions and the insolence of priestcraft and kingcraft, those creatures that make slaves of themselves, and have not the manliness to shake it off. Beard put it all in that book. I meant it to be there. I put a lot of it there and Beard put the rest. What publisher of mine in Hartford had an eye for the pennies, and he saved them. He did not waste any on the illustrations. He had a very good artist, Williams, who had never taken a lesson in drawing. Everything he did was original. The publisher hired the cheapest wood-dash engraver he could find, and in my early books you can see a trace of that. You can see that, if Williams had had a chance, he would have made some very good pictures. He had a good heart and good intentions. I had a character in the first book he illustrated, The Innocent Sabrod. That was a boy 17 or 18 years old, Jack Van Nostrand, a New York boy, who, to my mind, was a very remarkable creature. He and I tried to get Williams to understand that boy, and make a picture of Jack that would be worthy of Jack. Jack was a most singular combination. He was born and reared in New York here. He was as delicate in his feelings, as clean and pure, and refined in his feelings as any lovely girl that ever was, but whenever he expressed a feeling he did it in Bowery slang, and it was a most curious combination, that delicacy of his and that apparent coarseness. There was no coarseness inside of Jack at all, and Jack, in the course of 17 or 18 years, had acquired a capital of ignorance, that was marvelous ignorance of various things, not of all things. For instance, he did not know anything about the Bible. He had never been in Sunday school. Jack got more out of the Holy Land than anybody else, because the others knew what they were expecting, but it was a land of surprises to him. I said in the book that we found him watching a turtle on a log, stoning that turtle, and he was stoning that turtle because he had read that the song of the turtle was heard in the land, and this turtle wouldn't sing. It sounded absurd, but it was charged on Jack as a fact, and as he went along through that country he had a proper foil in an old rebel colonel, who was superintendent and head engineer in a large Sunday school in Wheeling, West Virginia. That man was full of enthusiasm wherever he went, and would stand and deliver himself of speeches, and Jack would listen to those speeches of the colonel and wonder. Jack had made a trip as a child almost across this continent in the first overland stagecoach. That man's name who ran that line of stages, well, I declare that name is gone. Well, names will go. Halliday, ah, that's the name, Ben Halliday, your uncle, turning to Mr. Carnegie. That was the fellow, Ben Halliday, and Jack was full of admiration at the prodigious speed that that line of stages made, and it was good speed, 125 miles a day, going day and night, and it was the event of Jack's life. And there at the Fords of the Jordan the colonel was inspired to a speech. He was always making a speech, so he called us up to him. He called up 5 sinners and 3 saints. It has been only lately that Mr. Carnegie beatified me. And he said, colon, here are the Fords of the Jordan, a monumental place. At this very point, when Moses brought the children of Israel through, he brought the children of Israel from Egypt through the desert, you see them, he guarded them through that desert patiently during 40 years, and brought them to this spot safe and sound. There you see, there is the scene of what Moses did. And Jack said, colon, Moses who? Oh, he says, Jack, you ought not to ask that. Moses, the great lawgiver. Moses, the great patriot. Moses, the great warrior. Moses, the great guide, who, as I tell you, brought these people through these 300 miles of sand in 40 years, and landed there safe and sound. Jack said, colon, there's nothing in that 300 miles in 40 years. Ben Halliday would have snaked them through in 36 hours. Well, I was speaking of Jack's innocence, and it was beautiful. Jack was not ignorant on all subjects. That boy was a deep student in the history of Anglo-Saxon liberty, and he was a patriot all the way through to the marrow. There was a subject that interested him all the time. Other subjects were of no concern to Jack, but that quaint, inscrutable innocence of his I could not get Williams to put into the picture. Yes, Williams wanted to do it. He said, colon, I will make him as innocent as a virgin. He thought a moment, and then said, I will make him as innocent as an unborn virgin, which covered the ground. I was reminded of Jack, because I came across a letter today which is over 30 years old that Jack wrote. Jack was doomed to consumption. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.